We all know that amateurs were in the forefront of early developments in radio communications. With FM, it was no different, only that it was a century or so later than the bulk of developments. Also, it cannot be denied that the ABC has played a leading role in the development of music broadcasting in Australia, not only classical, but in the popular field as well, along with drama, rural broadcasts, news, etc., etc. Following the end of World War II, the Commonwealth Government authorised the PMG's department to conduct testing to determine the viability of FM broadcasting in this country. Transmitters were installed in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane and went on the air from approximately 1946. By the mid-1950s, early 1960s, there was a tower at Jolimont, at No. 2 Jolimont Terrace to be exact, which played Sirius music from 3LO. At that time, 3LO was the classical station, later changed to 3AR. 3LO, on 770 kilocycles, went on to become ABC Melbourne 774 with the change of frequency spacing to 9 kHz separation. There was plenty of classical music on the ABC, but shared with other types of programming to the point where some people in the community felt that it was insufficient for their needs. We cannot ignore the role played by the ABC over the decades since its inception in 1932. Our capital city symphony orchestras would not have existed without ABC support, even if there were disputes between management and the artists. Overseas musicians were brought to Australia by the ABC, without whom many of our own performers would have had no chance of striving for greater things abroad than they could achieve here. Please remember that these were still the days when Europe was regarded as the pinnacle of success, and we still called England home. In these early years, and particularly in the Radio and Hobbies editions of November and December 1948, the legendary John Moyle wrote most effectively of how no doubt FM broadcasting would eventually displace AM, but at that time there was too much confusion amongst the public as to the differences. The main claim was that FM would give greater fidelity to music, a claim again heavily made in later decades when FM broadcasting was about to come to fruition. However, John Moyle succinctly and correctly pointed out that only if there were an AM and an FM station operating side by side on the same VHF band would one hear that there was virtually no difference at all as regards fidelity, and that an FM station would take up much more bandwidth than a comparable AM transmitter. John Moyle also pointed out that there was a definite lack of government policy on the whole issue, but that he had heard that the current thinking was to offer FM for the ABC only. Therefore, only two stations would use the new band in each city, and thus the public would be discriminated against, because even in those days, only about 10% of the population listened to the ABC. A brief word on my background and how I come to be involved. I am a trained keyboard musician who has specialised in church music. I wanted to be a priest and cathedral organist at St Paul's Cathedral, Melbourne, in Swanson Street, but the clergy selection board had other ideas. I became a secondary school teacher for 25 years, as well as playing in various parishes since 1957, from Brunswick to Frankston, with Benalla in North East Victoria and Charters Towers in North Queensland also in the mix. I was greatly influenced by two organists in the early 1960s. Barry Cabina, a brother of the main character in our story today, to whom I shall come in a minute. Barry was based in Calgary, Canada, and I met him at St. Paul's Cathedral one day, where he gave me invaluable tips on clarity of phrasing on an organ. The other was Pierre Cochereau, at the time organist of Notre Dame in Paris, who kindly invited me to return to Europe with him. In mid-1966 or 1968, I'm not sure which now, but my memory says 1966, my wife showed me a letter to the editor in the Age Green Guide of the day, commonly referred to as the Green Fink, in which the writer was calling for the formation of a body to press for the introduction of uninterrupted serious music broadcasting in Melbourne, and inviting interested readers to attend a meeting somewhere in Kew. We went along to a well-attended gathering in which the writer stated his views. We came home with me having been elected secretary to the Music Broadcasting Society of Victoria and my wife on the committee. Thus began 9 years of monthly meetings, phone calls, talking and visits to Canberra as the idea of introducing FM broadcasting in this country began to grow. My association with the Music Broadcasting Society of Victoria finished just after the station went on the air officially, because by then I was so tired physically and emotionally from being at school all day and at Kew every night that I could no longer walk a straight line. I had always been interested in radio and SWLing in particular. My involvement with the Music Broadcasting Society and those who talked about amateur radio was a big factor in guiding me to study and to my initial novice license. The central figure and driving force in our story was Brian Eccleston Cabina, VK3BEC, known on air as Beck. He was a naturally talented radio technician. He gained his amateur license in his teenage years after completing the theory exam in about 2 hours and had a radio repair shop at 146B Cotham Road, Kew, close to the corner of Cotham Road and Glenferrie Road, and only one tram stop from Kew Junction. This area is a slightly elevated one for the suburbs, a useful point for later on in this story. The fact that Brian had very little sight and was therefore legally blind as well as colourblind did not deter him from repairing radios. He was married with at least one daughter, and although he did not live at the Cotham Road premises, nevertheless, his wife or someone had to be close by so that they could tell Brian which was the red wire and not the green. He wore glasses for general sight, but for reading held everything up very closely so that he could focus on it. Here is his daughter reminiscing about her father in the 3MBS 40th birthday broadcast last year.
Because of those early experiences where he had to put himself forward and look after himself in that sense, he didn't have anyone else really, you know, didn't have that understanding and sympathy or empathy from people. Mm. When he couldn't do things the way people would expect him to be able to. Visually, he couldn't really appreciate things like art. He couldn't play sport. You know, he couldn't hit a tennis ball or anything like that. Mm. He didn't have the ability to appreciate that sort of thing, I suppose. He had a lot of empathy for other people with disabilities. So there were, occasionally, you would find there were somebody else working for him, or I think also working in those early days at 3MBS with some other sort of disability as well, because he had a great desire to help anybody who he imagined, you know, was going through the same sort of frustrations he had.
Brian was an active amateur, and I know used to talk on 2 metres, but whether on AM or FM, simplex or repeater, I do not know. Peter Wolfenden, VK3RV, may remember, as he remembers Brian attending meetings of the VHF group of the day and speaking passionately about issues which were on his mind, especially the need for serious music broadcasting. By the term speaking passionately, I mean to imply that Brian really thought that everyone listening to him should adopt his interests as wholeheartedly as he did. He was someone who was very dissatisfied with the amount of on-air classical music presentation on the one hand, and on the other, the amount of talk that went with those programs. At the time, most music broadcasting was reliant on records being played in the studio, but there would be breaks for news, sporting events, and parliament. There was also a lot of talking about each record, the work itself and the performers. However, in the hands of Arthur Burridge and John Royal, names which may be familiar to some of you here today, there was always a pause of 10 seconds or so after a record finished to allow listeners to contemplate the majesty or whatever of the performance that they had just heard. I am sorry to say that that little luxury is not extended to us today. Even in the 1960s, when MBS started, there was only the ABC with its relay of classical music programs and an occasional live concert from the Melbourne Town Hall. There was also very little in the way of equipment for the public, even though John Moyle and his team had several articles earlier on construction of FM tuners. My first introduction to an FM tuner was one which Brian Cabina imported from Japan to be the station monitor when the MBS eventually got its license. I remember thinking that it sounded very bassy any time I heard it in operation. By the way, let's not forget, too, that radio people were still thinking in terms of mono broadcasting at this time. Stereo was also being investigated and developed, along with the gradual introduction of the microgroove record. I remember 3XY making a great feature of this new vinyl style of recording at one stage, along with the variable width groove 78 RPM record. Interestingly, Peter Wolfenden, VK3RV, known to many of us here today, told me that a friend of his had returned from overseas holiday with a new hi-fi FM tuner. And Peter was tuning around on it when he heard the local Jollymont transmitter. He thought that the fidelity was just the same as AM, but when a live concert came on, he could immediately hear the difference. The formation of the Music Broadcasting Society of Victoria led to many years of letters, telephone calls, and 2 visits to Canberra for Brian and me to lobby governments of the day and the radio licensing authority of the time. What we were proposing was new as far as broadcasting was concerned, that is, a VHF band for high fidelity stereo music broadcasting. We learnt very quickly that again, there was still no definite policy within government circles, and our 2 visits to Canberra were to talk to the then Minister of Communications, Mr. Moss Cass, and officers from his department. For quite some years, they decided that the best place for us was up on the UHF frequencies, where there was little activity and bandwidth would be no problem. Our argument was that that would put Australia on a separate path from the rest of the world, where, in countries that had introduced FM broadcasting, there was an allocation in the 88 to 108 megahertz section of VHF. There may have been individual variations to these band limits, but that was the commonly used allocation. Here is what I had to say in the 3MBS 40th anniversary broadcast in July last year. In 1966, in June, there was a little notice appeared in the Age Green Paper of the day saying that an organisation called the Music Broadcasting Society was being formed. And my wife, Evelyn, sort of showed me this. And she said, "Are you interested?" And I said, "Well, yes, I'm sure I can be." So we both went along to the initial meeting. But quite a number of people came, and from that, a small committee was elected. And that's where I got the job of being the initial secretary of the Music Broadcasting Society. Brian Cabina was one of those men with a vision. I worked out that he had this vision of a good quality music station on the air without any chat. So his idea was, well, let's form a subscription station where what we'll play will be made available via a pamphlet. As well as all the negotiations going on, Brian Cabina was busy designing an FM stereo transmitter and planning to construct it in an upstairs room over his shop in Cotham Road, Kew. Little by little, bits and pieces were purchased, paid for by a combination of funds already raised from early subscribers to the society and Brian's own resources. The upstairs rooms were obviously built originally as living quarters for the shop owner, but with Brian they had been cleaned out and were vacant. One day a large metal cabinet was installed and construction of the transmitter commenced. I remember offering to help with that, even though I was not a technical type and concentrated on the secretarial work and making plans for early programming. Someone whose name may be well known to many of you here is Craig Glidden. Craig had been a licensed amateur radio operator for many years and continued to be so for a long time after the period of which I am now speaking, namely the late 1960s and early 1970s. I did not really know Craig, but I certainly knew who he was when he would be in the rooms at night helping to assemble everything. I have a vague recollection that Drew Diamond, VK3XU, may have been involved too, but I'm not at all sure about that. Here is a few words from Craig Glidden himself.
I first attended a meeting of the society, I suspect it was 1971 or 72, I can't remember. But I was actually was suggested by a friend of mine at the university. I was doing a postgraduate degree in engineering at that time. And he said, "Oh, you might be able to come along and help." So I went along to the meeting and met Brian. And Brian, I think, was really carrying the can for all the technical development, so we volunteered to help. And I started to help him build an ultra-high-frequency antenna for some test transmissions because he was thinking we might get an ultra-high-frequency license back then. Well, back in those days, of course, Brian started building all the equipment for the station himself. We couldn't afford it. I mean, there was commercial equipment available, of course, in the States, but it was well beyond our means, so we basically rolled our own. And this was an enormous amount of work. We had to build the stereo generator system and the 1,000-watt transmitter.
I remember that great was the excitement when it became known that permission had been given for a tower to be erected in the backyard of 146B Cotham Road. I would have liked to have been able to photograph its installation, as it had to be lifted over the building by crane and placed into a very large block of concrete, 6 feet square and 10 feet deep. However, my school commitments precluded me from seeing that happen. I was, however, very excited when I went over that night and saw this great mast in place. Next came the antenna, a 12-bay array of horizontally mounted dipoles. I knew enough about radio to ask Brian if it would be possible for cars to receive from that system, and he said that, and I quote, He was confident that there would be enough vertical radiation for mobiles to be able to hear it. End of quote. A neighbour of Brian Kabina, a Mr. Bill Ruffley, made shells and cabinets for LPs and amplifiers for volunteers to prepare programs. The accession system, common in libraries, was used to catalogue all the records. One day in 1974, both 3MBS and 2MBS received their licences, and Brian was now clear to finalise all his building and planning to get on the air. There was always friendly rivalry between Sydney and Melbourne as to which station went to air first. But here in Melbourne, this happened on the 2nd of July 1975 at 6 p.m. on a frequency of 92.7 MHz and an output power of approximately 400 watts. In other words, the transmitter driver was put to air, but no PA stage. It was my privilege to make the opening announcement. I know that I recorded it at the time on a cassette, but sadly I have never been able to find it since, something that I now regret very much indeed. Brian's policy was that there would be no announcements, just details of works to be played, published on foolscap paper and supplied to subscribers. At the time, I had no quarrel with this approach, because I, too, was sick of the amount of talk that went on around the works played on the ABC. With the passage of time, one has to ask if anything has changed at the ABC. The answer is no. Brian actually removed the microphone from the transmitter and replaced it with a cart machine for any announcements that may be required. Therefore, the volunteers recorded anything needed, and it was switched at the transmitter table, along with the volunteer on duty having to line up particular tracks on the LPs. This attitude did lead to two confrontations with the broadcasting authority of the day, and cancellation of the license was threatened. Brian compromised his way around that, whilst still achieving a minimum of announcements. In 1978, the Fraser government, which followed Mr. Whitlam, had as its communications minister a Mr. Tony Staley. In 1978, when 3MBS had been on air for almost 3 years, Tony Staley called a parliamentary inquiry into the broadening of broadcast licences, as there had by then been attempts at community broadcasting via SBS and its early attempts at foreign language stations, as well as special interest groups and country areas requesting access to individualised and local programming. In this, Brian Kabina was greatly helped by a Mr. John Lillywhite, a volunteer at the time and father of Judy Gordon, one of our guests here today. The outcome of this inquiry was that in the capital cities, 4 licences were granted on the basis of 3 S special licences and 1 E educational licence. 3MBS was granted one of the S licences along with a change of frequency. At this stage, I shall stop, as anything else I have to say will only develop into an history of the Music Broadcasting Society of Victoria itself, the company which still exists to run 3MBS. If you would like to hear more about that, then please let me know and I can talk to our OTN editor, Bill Roper, and ask if he may like an article for the journal. Suffice it to say that the ABC was 6 months behind MBS in establishing its ABC FM network. Many AM stations decided to move to FM, and the SIGs were eventually accommodated. The rest, as they say, is history. Now we are reaching a time when some countries are even banning FM broadcasts in favour of digital. Thank you for your attention, and I would particularly like to thank Mike Ide, VK3KTO, Peter Wolfenden, VK3RV, Judy Gordon, XYL of RAOTC committee member Jim Gordon, and the 3MBS 40th birthday broadcast for their background comments as I was preparing these notes.